On this week's 51%, three generations of women talk about their now federally recognized tribe. A speech pathologist has a book out on hope after strokes.
My goal was to give people accurate, simplified information they could readily understand. I wanted them to feel smart and empowered.
And Gilles Malkin profiles a woman in history. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The Little Shell tribe of Chippewa Indians was federally recognized in late 2019 after more than 100 years of fighting for the designation. This story from the University of Montana series Project Little Shell explores questions of enrollment for three generations of women in one family.
I'm Victory Vaez. For Ikutsimiskimakibek, or Iku for short, connection to land is part of who she is. That includes land where her family's buried. We're at the Augusta Cemetery at the base of the Rocky Mountain Front. It's where generations of her family are.
Because I've come out here my entire life. So it's also a way for my mom to explain to us who all our relatives are, and like the family tree is by coming out here. And
surrounding the cemetery are lands the Blackfeet Indians inhabited for hundreds of years. Iku, who's 24 years old, is currently enrolled in the Blackfeet Nation, but not as a full member.
Right now, in Blackfeet, I'm a descendant, which means that I can't vote and I can't receive certain benefits. Like I can't get.
That's because she doesn't have enough blood quantum, which is starting to push out young people who don't have children within their tribe. In addition to being Blackfeet, Iku's also Métis and white. Being mixed race was tough for her growing up. She didn't feel like she belonged in any one group.
In Native communities, I find it really important to identify myself as mixed race because there's a lot of shame around being mixed race, and I feel like there should be no shame in that because, again, there's no way that you can change the fact that you have white blood. So I just feel it's important to always state that.
Métis culture and heritage originates from the early days of the fur trade, when Europeans mixed with Natives. The largest Métis group in Montana, where Iku lives and works, is the Little Shell tribe. That tribe has been fighting for federal recognition for more than 100 years. In late 2019, they finally got it. That's a big deal. And Iku Bek is among descendants who now want in a way they didn't before.
I want to be able to vote and be an actual member of a sovereign nation versus a descendant of a sovereign nation right now.
Iku, who grew up in Missoula and went to Harvard for her undergrad, has to disenroll from Blackfeet to enroll into the Little Shell tribe. University of Montana professor Rosalyn Lapierre, who's written a lot about Native identity and activism, doesn't really agree with that.
The United States government only allows individuals to enroll in one tribe and not two. So even if you come from two tribes or three tribes, legally you're supposed to only be allowed to enroll in one tribe. So first of all, I think that's hogwash.
Lapierre is a professor of environmental studies at UM. She's Métis and enrolled in the Blackfeet Nation. And she's also Iku's mom.
I think that, you know, Iku should be allowed to be enrolled both at Blackfeet and at Little Shell. I think that being enrolled at Little Shell, because she'll be a full enrolled member and not a descendant of the tribe, she will have more rights.
As often as she can, Iku drives from Missoula to the reservation, visiting her grandmother, aunt, and other family. Along the way are Augusta and Shoto, small towns where Métis lived and thrived, including her own. Angie Lapierre lives in the heart of Browning, where her fenced yard doesn't keep out the neighbor's dogs. Inside, she and her granddaughter go through the many photo albums.
It's just a baby. Look at his tight outfit.
Yeah.
And talk about life and family.
My children, Rosalyn and Bill, their dad is Chippewa from Turtle Mountain, which is part of that little shell that left Turtle Mountain. They were always called the landless Indians because they didn't have any land. Even though they were landless Indians, they knew they lived in Augusta. They knew they lived outside of Hill 57. They knew they lived in Great Falls, you know.
Angie says it isn't fair that the Little Shell needed to wait so long for recognition. They had been living here long before a federal government was around, from either the U.S. or Canada, which is only about an hour north.
We're First Nations. This is our land. It has always been our land. We're First Nation. It's our right. We're from here. You know, our ancestors are, you know, from here.
The recognition of Métis identity in the United States and Canada has been slow. And the Little Shell people are finally winning a political battle they've been fighting for over a century. Here's Iku.
I've enjoyed the fact that federal recognition happened because it actually made me look into it. Because before, I was just disregarding that identity in my life because it wasn't important to me and it served no purpose, honestly. Like, that's how I felt. And so I'm glad that I had the opportunity to realize that I can also just have culture without federal recognition as well, although it took federal recognition for me to really, like, care a little more deeply than before, I suppose.
In Montana, I'm Victory Baez.
The story is part of the University of Montana's Project Little Shell, a series reported by undergraduate and graduate journalism students. Dr. Sharon Ufberg returns with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews a woman who has helped thousands of clients transition through serious health crises and brain injuries. Sigoina Tansman, a speech pathologist and life coach for more than 25 years, is the author of Hope After Stroke for Caregivers and Survivors, The Holistic Guide to Getting Your Life Back. It's being called the Stroke Bible.
I want to just jump right in and ask you what made you write this book, Hope After Stroke, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
Yeah. Well, for, as you mentioned, for more than 25 years working with stroke survivors and their families, I saw chaos, confusion, and really hopelessness because there wasn't a single go-to spot to get information or that big picture about how that stroke would affect the survivor or the family for the short or the long term because there's so many physical, emotional, and even financial concerns. So people had to cobble together these resources. But, you know, the truth is they really didn't even know where to look or what to ask. There was kind of no timeline of, you know, what happened now, what's next, and what now. And people were thrust, I think, into a kind of, they are, into this catastrophic event trying to make sense of everything, especially the medical jargon. And they most of all felt disempowered, fearful, and really hopeless.
So were you trying to accomplish some sense of, you know, control back for them? Or what was your hope when you sat down to write this? Because I know, having looked at the book, that the info in the book is not just for the survivor, but it's also for the caregiver. And that's really fed through each chapter of the book, which I find so interesting and very, very helpful probably for those that get to look at it. So in your mind, as you were writing it, what made you write it in that way, and what were you hoping it would do for the people reading it?
Well, it's such an interesting question because I had so many people say to me, well, who are you writing this for? Is it for the caregiver or for the survivor? And I know that in working with people for so many years that it's a dance because in the beginning, certainly the caregiver leads this way, but ultimately, it's up to the survivor. It's the survivor's life. And so there are times when it's more directed towards a caregiver, and as a survivor becomes more capable, they're going to be able to go back and understand some things as well. So, you know, first and foremost, what I wanted readers to have was hope. Because when I asked my patients what they felt the most valuable thing they got from me was, they all said hope. And, you know, honestly, I thought it would be maybe some strategy or tool I'd given them. But honestly, it was hope. And I think that my goal was that we have to awaken that feeling of hope within that person in order for them to even see a possibility for recovery. I had a patient's wife actually mention to me when I had asked her what she had gotten, what she thought was the most valuable thing. And she said that I was, in fact, the only person that had given them any hope when her husband, who happened to be a Stanford-educated superior court judge, I mean, he had such a devastating stroke that he was paralyzed on one side, couldn't utter a single intelligible word. He couldn't even point to a simple object like a cup when he was given a choice of three objects. We always say, point to the cup. Couldn't even do that. So obviously nobody predicted that this judge would be able to go back to work. But in reality, after several years of very hard work in therapy and undergoing such exhaustive neuropsych testing that I don't know if many un-brain-damaged people could pass that, he was able to return to the bench, and he practiced for another 10 years before he retired. So, I mean, I like to say hope is the fuel of recovery and action is the vehicle. So my goal was to give people accurate, simplified information they could readily understand. I wanted them to feel smart and empowered.
Because you have so much knowledge about stroke, talk a little bit about how stroke is particular to women and what, if you know them, what are the stats on the percentages of women who have stroke and, you know, the percentages of women who are the caregivers of stroke survivors?
Right. Well, yeah, stroke does seem to be more of a woman's issue. That's like one piece of the pie that we don't want more of. It's about 60% strokes compared to men. That's in part because women do live longer, but the other risk that women bear is that they're affected by their hormonal status, including pregnancy and childbirth. You know, so women do have more strokes than men, but they are also more often the primary caregiver when a man is having a stroke. So we have it kind of both ways. And there's a unique factor about women that really hits single women that makes them at more risk. And that is they're not as likely to call for help when they're experiencing some symptoms. They may be more aware than a man is of the symptoms, but they tend not to call because they don't have time for that. They've got people to take care of, and they've got people depending on them. So that factor in and of itself makes it an even more dangerous factor for women.
You had mentioned that more women die of stroke, 60 to 40, you know, 60%
yes.
women versus 40% men, that more women die of stroke, and that, you know, 80% of strokes are preventable. And so I thought perhaps while we're together, you could talk a little bit about what should a woman or a man look for if they suspect they're having a stroke or someone they're with might suspect someone's having a stroke.
Well, the acronym FAST, for starters, is the well-known acronym. And the F in FAST starts for your face. So you start to look for asymmetry. When you ask a person to smile, usually one side of the face might be drooping. So F stands for face. A stands for arms. That means have the person raise their arms. Very often a stroke will affect one side or the other of the body. So if there's, again, asymmetry. S stands for speech. Ask them to say something. Ask them to name their, you know, name and address. We're listening for slurred speech, incomprehensible words, almost drunk-sounding speech. And T is the most important part. T stands for time, because for every second that's lost, millions of neurons are dying. And that's a really huge part of this component. We want people to take action because there are two types of strokes. One is a blocked type of stroke, and the other is a bleed. But either one requires immediate action. But in the blocked type of stroke, there's a brief window, a 3.5-hour window, where those neurological symptoms can be reversed. And that requires rapid attention and time getting to the hospital. So that there's a medication called TPA that can be administered, or there's also a surgical procedure that could remove that blockage in the artery, but you're so limited in your time, and that's the critical factor. And women, by the way, are more likely to call for an ambulance or get medical attention for a male partner versus the other way around.
Well, that's not surprising, is it?
Well, and that's one of the reasons, right, that we see that women do suffer more of these. I mean, disability is perhaps, I think, an even worse outcome than death, quite honestly, because this is the fourth leading cause of long-term disability for men or for women, and that's a huge problem.
Why should people feel there is hope then after stroke? You know, you've talked about the hope you give them. What is it about the brain, about a stroke victim that you know that could give someone hope that they might recover?
Well, the brain is very resilient and recovers way beyond the typical 3 to 6 month mark, where people's doctors are saying to them, you know, at 6 months, that's pretty much as good as it gets. And I have worked with literally thousands of people. And if you go online and listen to any of the stroke online support groups and listen to the people, you will hear person after person say, my doctor said I could never walk, I would never talk, I would never drive, I would never go back to work, I would never have another baby, because they don't see the long, long term of it. So the brain is resilient. You may have heard this one term. It's kind of a buzzword now, but it's been around since the early 70s, and really, actually, if you delve into the literature way beyond that, the buzzword is neuroplasticity. So what neuroplasticity is this: the brain's really spectacular ability to change and reorganize itself. And it does it by growing new neural pathways. So as it turns out, it's the connections between the neurons that's more powerful than the number of neurons. And if I had to simplify what neuroplasticity is, it's really repetition. It's doing something over and over and over again. We all benefit from neuroplasticity, for better or for worse, by the things that we do every day. Our brains are simply changing all the time by the activities that we engage ourselves in, by the thoughts that we think. So it's really important that as a person is recovering and working on those basic skills, like motor skills of walking and talking, that they get great therapy and that they do repeatedly engage in these processes, because they are growing new pathways to create a new brain.
So are some of the things that they would find in your book, would they be some of these simple practices as well as advice?
Yes, absolutely they are. And first and foremost, I want to say that, you know, stroke survivors are first and foremost human beings, right? So the best life practices that we choose as really functional and dynamic human beings that can, you know, engage with other people should be practices that those people engage in as well. So there are lots of easy tips and tools and resources in this book that will help people for sure, as well as the caregiver. And a lot of that has to do with setting a mindset. You know, the long term of recovery requires a mindset that can get you to get up and do the hard thing. It is way harder than, you know, you or I deciding whether we should go for a run or a jog today. I mean, literally it gets down to, you know, will I be able to roll out of bed today for some people? And every stroke is completely different. So there are general practices for everybody that will benefit both the caregiver and the survivor.
So Gwynya Tansman, this has been so helpful, and I could talk to you for a lot longer, but I think first we should find out, where can people find you? Where can people find the book? You know, what forms is it currently in? Can you give us some of that information for the people that are listening today?
Yes. So for starters, if people want to get in touch with me, the best way is hopeafterstrokenow, all one word, hopeafterstrokenow@gmail.com. I do have a website too. It's hope-stroke.com. And the book is available on Amazon in both digital and paperback form. And the audiobook has just come out, I'm very happy to say. That's a great tool for very busy caregivers or stroke survivors that can't read, because many of them lose that ability to read. The audiobook is out on Google Play, on Apple Books, on Chirp, and many other audiobook sites, both by subscription or by just a la carte, you know, buy it by a single one. It should be out on Audible very soon. And there is a bonus I'd like to offer your listeners. It's a 21-day sample recovery workbook and journal. If they contact me at hopeafterstrokenow@gmail.com, they can get it. But there's also a link if they purchase the book online. And right at the very first page, there's a little link that they can contact, and they will have a downloadable sample of this recovery workbook and journal available to them.
Thank you so much. That's going to Tansman with her book, Hope After Stroke, for the caregiver and the survivor. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. Gilles Malkin brings us a profile from his Women in History series about the best-known anthropologist of the 20th century. And during this time of response, recovery, and reimagining, perhaps weaving some of her views into our new social fabric could help.
There are voices from time to time that rise above the din of opinion and conjecture with the results of hard work. And these voices are readily recognizable by their elements of common sense and their appeal to our appreciation of cause and effect. Such a voice was that of Margaret Mead, an anthropologist who studied the cultural structures, attitudes, and sexual mores of the far-off peoples of Southeast Asia, and shared with us how they approached life and spoke to us about them in a way that made us consider ourselves. Mead was born in Philadelphia in 1901 and majored in psychology at Barnard College, then earned both a master's degree and a Ph.D. at Columbia University in an era when very few women were admitted to higher education. Mead was greatly influenced by her teacher at Columbia, Frank Boas, known as the father of modern anthropology, and it was he who suggested she study the life of the people of Samoa. Mead's approach was to immerse herself in the place and among the people she was writing about, and so set off to the other side of the earth. She set about analyzing the Samoans' culture and customs, and her writing disputed the notion that these non-modern communities were primitive and naive, against the assumption that Western ways were the attainment and pinnacle of all possibilities for human civilization. Mead chipped away at the beliefs that Western societal traits are universal and explained that the development of Samoans young was not simply dependent upon gender or age, at least not as definitively as in the West. She showed that every aspect of a people's culture is interconnected, so the shaping of their ideas and archetypes rest upon their particular life patterns. She felt that this paradigm needed to be raised to a higher degree of importance when examining the formative process of any people. In her resultant controversial 1928 book, Coming of Age in Samoa, Mead described how the encouragement Samoan society offered its young by providing greater opportunity to freely witness adults' behavior was a prime positive influence in its children's development. Samoans were not without stringent rules and expectations with their own role definitions for the young, but growing up was much less stressful for youngsters in a society in which adults did not conceal their activities regarding birthing, death, bodily functions, and sex. Samoan girls were not pressured to marry young and could engage in casual sex until the right situation came along, but this was not a total free love society. Marriages were arranged by taking into consideration each spouse's fortune, occupation, and social standing. Samoan culture also included the acceptance of divorce. Monogamy was not the universal rule, and having simultaneous relationships could be regarded as healthy. Mead told of how they regarded changes in one's partners as well as in one's sexual proclivities throughout one's life as natural. This was welcome news for Western women who were seeking to break out of the pressures brought to bear upon them by a culture that sought to mold them like muffins. Mead advised that a more expansive attitude toward our own culture might bring out wisdom we may have mislaid in our hurry to shape our future. Mead herself was married 3 times and had prolonged relationships with 2 of her husbands, and letters suggest a romantic relationship with another female as well. Margaret Mead attacked the belief that race was a factor of superior or inferior intelligence. She pointed out that the methods used in forming any such conclusions would be wholly inadequate, such as determining how much of any race any person might be, how to get around language barriers, and the absence of any control groups to compare race with intelligence. Margaret Mead originated an interview study of Jewish villages in Europe, the shtetls, through questioning people who were returning to them from America, the publication of which resulted in, or at least greatly magnified, the stereotype of the Jewish mother, who controls the family by instilling guilt-ridden love among her children through emotional suffocation relating to her suffering for their sakes. In 1972, Margaret Mead was elected president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She died in 1978 of pancreatic cancer. A year later, the Presidential Medal of Freedom was awarded in her memory by President Jimmy Carter. It is Margaret Mead who is credited with the maxim, "Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, musician, actor, composer, and advocate for people with disabilities. He lives in upstate New York. His Women in History series contains essays that depict the lives and accomplishments of women who made a difference against significant odds. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1611.